begun doing consulting work for an Iraqi NGO called Nature Rec. Their work was to baseline the environmental conditions in the country while violence was still occurring. And I just thought that was phenomenal, and I chose that as my thesis topic. I graduated at the end of 2009, and shortly thereafter scored, you know, what I thought was my dream job, and working as a communications and outreach specialist for a USAID project in Baghdad. Their work had to do with training over 100,000 Iraqi civil servants in how to rebuild their country.
For nearly 9 years, our nation has been at war in Iraq. I'm proud to finally say these two words, and I know your families agree. Welcome home. Welcome home.
You know, my son called me a couple of days after 9/11 and said, "Hey, Mom, me and Mikey, we're going to sign up. We're going to go get them." And I was like, "Get who?" As my, you know, heart stopped. And he said, "We're going to get them, the people who did this." And I said, "Well, who did this? We don't know who did this. Who are you going to go get? Don't you think you should wait till we know who did this before you go get them?" Sometimes I think I'm the one who went, so they wouldn't have to. Because I would rather it be me than them. I think I put a lot of faces where people had friendly, happy, family faces to what people previously thought of as terrorists and scary and dark. And I think I was able to show a lot of people that, you know, we're not that much different. We all want basically the same things. We want a nice job so we can have a nice vacation. We want dinner on the table with our family at the end of the day. And we want to live in peace.
Lorna's haunting photographs and poignant stories enable her audience to share the tragedy, the struggle, the triumph of the Iraqi people. And they raise larger questions about the war, a war that was never necessary, which could have been stopped if only the warmongering governments heard the voice of the people. And that's it, everyone, for this week on Aperture. Until another episode right here on Aperture, goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson: knowledge versus ignorance. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. The righteous scholars are the witness of the truth and Allah's oneness. knowledge is the best asset one can have. They know the true knowledge and fear of Allah could be attained only by reading and grasping Allah's signs, the verses, the ayat, in the Quran and the universe, as we see in chapter 35 of Quran, verse number 28 alludes to this reality. All knowledge as per the Quranic worldview is important, for it all brings man closer to his creator and master, and facilitates the fulfillment of his honorable vicegerency mission on earth. As you all know, that we are the representative of Allah on this earth, right? And for that, it is important for us to have a Quranic worldview, something, a worldview that is based on the Holy Quran. Being knowledgeable makes the people progressive, visionary, devout, and morally strong. It makes them human above all. It makes them true sons of Adam, for they keep his knowledge legacy alive for the benefit of all creatures and in both worlds. See, sometimes we think when it comes to knowledge, that knowledge is confined and restricted to this world and worldly realm only. And there are other times where we think that knowledge is something that is going to benefit us only in the hereafter. Well, the truth of the matter is that knowledge, especially the divine knowledge, the beneficial knowledge, is going to benefit us not only in this world, but also in the hereafter, about the affairs of the hereafter, what we're going to go through in the hereafter. All of that is beneficial for human beings. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing knowledge versus ignorance. And we said knowledge, you know, let it be knowledge that is merely used in this world, or knowledge that we acquire is after and about the afterlife, the hereafter, the real life. Both of them are beneficial for human beings. That said, being ignorant, as per the Quranic assessment, is unnatural, abnormal, and suicidal, and plain un-Islamic. There is no pride in being ignorant, in not knowing anything, in being illiterate, you know, somebody who doesn't know anything. Nonetheless, due to the vastness of the realm of knowledge, some types and segments are more important than others. Some could be categorized as obligatory, others are recommended, and yet others are just permissible. Some also could be qualified as individual and others as collective responsibility. All of that comes about as a result of seeking knowledge. Needless to say that the best of all branches of knowledge are the sciences of Islam, with which a person learns about his Creator and Lord, his Messenger, his Quran, and his religion. Specifically, such religious injunctions, themes, and principles as needed for a person's everyday functioning as an exemplary Muslim. So remember that we in our lifetimes have to tread towards being knowledgeable, not prefer to be ignorant. Being ignorant is not the natural course of our life. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Limelight.
The 25 richest Americans pay little to no taxes thanks to leveraging loopholes in the tax code, according to a report from ProPublica released recently. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Alexis Goldstein, reporter. This article is published under the heading 25 Richest Americans Pay Few Taxes, Partly Thanks to the Family Fund Loophole. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The 25 richest Americans pay little to no taxes thanks to leveraging loopholes in the tax code, according to a report from ProPublica released recently. Billionaires like Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, and Michael Bloomberg are able to pay so little because of policy decisions that result from the lobbying pressure of large corporations like the ones these billionaires run. The problems include the lack of a U.S. wealth tax and the fact that labor is taxed at a higher rate than investment. But to add insult to injury, as the ultra-wealthy take advantage of the fact that capital gains on investments are taxed at a far lower rate than incomes, they are building portfolios of investments that further increase their political power and more deeply entrench inequality. The wealthy have many options to further increase their wealth, including investment in hedge funds, private investment funds which charge high fees but hold out the promise of returns better than the overall stock market. The 2010 Dodd-Frank Act created new rules of the road for hedge funds, including new transparency into what they own. Once a quarter, they must report certain positions on a form called 13F. But family funds, in which only the wealth of a single family is invested, lack this same level of transparency as they were carved out of the Dodd-Frank Act. Many of the billionaires ProPublica found are paying little to no taxes, are also growing their wealth through family investment offices. Family funds have been in the news this year following the spectacular blow-up of Archegos Capital. Archegos, created in 2013 by former hedge fund manager Bill Huang, 1 year after he settled charges of insider trading with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, made a series of increasingly risky fortunes that the price of about a dozen stocks would keep rising. He used money borrowed from some of the biggest banks to amplify these fortunes. When these fortunes went south and he couldn't pay the banks what he owed, it led to an estimated $10 billion in losses across the banks, with Credit Suisse taking the biggest hit, $5.5 billion. The lack of public reporting on Archegos positions contributed to the fact that none of the banks knew until it was too late that they were all on the same side of the same bad trade. Archegos wreaked havoc at the largest banks with a fund worth an estimated $20 billion. Amazon founder and executive chairman Jeff Bezos runs a family fund that's even larger. Bezos Expeditions was estimated to be worth a staggering $107 billion in 2020. Bezos Expeditions is described by Crunchbase as a family investment office that manages Bezos venture capital investments. It was through Bezos Expeditions that Bezos purchased the Washington Post and created the private space travel firm Blue Origin. But Bezos Expeditions has a host of other investments in companies further entrenching the gig economy. Bezos Expeditions website discloses some of its other select investments, which include home sharing app Airbnb, which has been accused of skirting state hoteling laws and of displacing long-term residents, and ride-sharing app Uber, which has fought laws of classify its drivers as employees. Bezos Expeditions also invested in Nextdoor, which in some cities has become a sort of crowdsourced private surveillance network. Martins and Ross Martins noted for Wall Street on Parade, Bezos Expeditions has never filed a single 13F form with the SEC. This means the general public has no transparency into which stocks or options he holds. But Bezos is still able to take advantage of losses on his investments, and by disclosing those losses to the IRS, he paid no taxes in 2011, despite having a personal net worth of $18 billion. Microsoft founder Bill Gates also has a family investment office, Cascade Investments LLC, that has allowed him to amass the largest private ownership of farmland in the U.S. Gates and Melinda French Gates all together own 269,000 acres of farmland through companies that all link back to Cascade Investments. Gates may have attempted to add even more secrecy to these purchases by using a series of limited liability shell companies. An NBC News investigation found that Cascade Investments bought farmland using at least 22 limited liability shell companies across the United States. John S. Cordman, a Georgia farmer and landowner, told NBC News that he discovered by searching property records that companies buying multiple tracts of land in Georgia were all a shell of a shell of a shell company investing for Bill Gates. This raises questions about concentration of power over farmland from the same man who made his fortune through inadequate antitrust enforcement, leading to Microsoft concentration of power in the PC business. Michael Bloomberg also has a family investment office called Willett Advisors. Capro Asia estimated that in 2020, Willett Advisors worth $25 billion, which would make it the seventh largest family office in the world. Wall Street on Parade noted that the last Form 13F the firm files dates back to 2014, when the fund had a mere $273,000 in assets. Elon Musk appears to have used his family investment office, Accession LLC, to buy up some $100 million in property in California around his mansion. Limited liability companies with ties to Musk purchased six houses across two streets in the wealthy Bel Air neighborhood of Los Angeles. At least one of those LLCs share a P.O. box with Accession LLC, Musk's family office, the Wall Street Journal reported. While reporting has given us some insights into what these families' funds are doing, regulations don't require the sorts of disclosures that hedge funds must make, allowing family offices' investments to largely remain in the shadows, providing yet another benefit to the billionaires of the nation. Today's tax code incentivizes the nation's billionaires to plow as much of their money as possible into investments in these family funds, further amplifying their wealth and giving them larger influence over the political process. With these investments, they seed companies like Uber that fight against workers' rights or buy up farmland, making it harder for smaller farmers to compete. To her credit, House Financial Services Committee Chairwoman Maxine Waters has proposed draft legislation requiring family funds managing more than $750 million to provide disclosures about their investments. Broader legislation, including a wealth tax, is sorely needed to address the inequalities that family funds create. Waters' bill is a good start. Bringing more transparency into family offices could be an important first step for Congress to tackle this sprawling problem.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
Islamati.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Youth Station. Choo choo kachoo. It's the Youth Station for you. I'm your humble host, Muzaffar Haider. And here in the studio today, we have with us our dearly beloved friend, Mehdi Najafi. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you for having us. And
a man who needs no introduction.
Oh, yeah, precisely. Precisely.
It's good to have you. So you're a married man, right?
Oh, yes, I am, luckily.
Any regrets?
Any regrets? Yes. Why not sooner?
Ahsan. Good answer. Yeah. No, that's the topic that we're actually discussing today about unrealistic thoughts when it comes to marriage. There's lots of expectations that people have before they get married, and because of those expectations, their marriages either fall apart or, you know, they're just very,
they
very
don't
lucky.
Happen sometimes.
Or they don't. Yeah, they don't happen. You know. Where do these unrealistic thoughts come from?
In society?
Fact, first of all, what are they?
Yeah, what are they? I don't know. But, like, I'll give you a closer example of my older brother. Well, he's given up on those unrealistic things that he had in mind. But there was one of these things that he was like, all right, fine. I need to have a minimum income of this much, he had in his mind. And I need to own a house before I get married. These two are enough for me. For someone to be hindered in getting married.
And sometimes the woman has similar expectations. She's like, he needs to have a bank account, he needs to have a good job, he needs to... Whereas the Islamic ethos is actually the opposite. It's like, you get married, and I will give you risk.
Yeah.
I will increase your risk. But then we're expected for our risk to increase before we get married. Kind of backwards.
Yeah, I know. Mm. And some people... there's a tradition where this guy was already married and he didn't have enough risk to support his family, and he was told to remarry until his risk actually got opened. Well, I'm not trying to promote...
Let's hope our wives are not listening.
we hope, but yeah. As you said, I was trying to explain that getting married is the reason your risk is going to get increased.
Mm. There's actually a really funny story where this guy, he has nothing. He's like, you know, just a regular guy. Like me and you back in the day before we got married, you know, we would wait until Shahriya comes through so that we can go and buy a burger. Do you remember those days?
Yeah.
The good days.
Yeah.
Anyway, so he had nothing, and then he gets married. Allah increases his risk. He gets a house. He has a car now. He has all the usual stuff. His uncle comes to him and he says, hey, how did you get all this stuff? The kid says, well, Allah said, get married and I will increase your risk. That's what I did. I got married and Allah increased my risk. The uncle says, hey, hold on a second. I don't believe that. No, what did you really do? Come on, give me a clue. The kid says, no, really, I just got married and Allah increased my risk. I haven't been doing anything really differently. Third time the uncle asks, and so the kid goes, all right, fine, you got me. I'm going to tell you the truth. Basically, I have this Jewish friend, and he told me if you get married, I'm going to provide everything for you. I'm going to give you your finances, your house, your mortgage, your car, and everything. And the uncle goes, ah, there it is. The youth goes, actually, no, I just made that up.
Yeah.
But I find it so strange that you would believe in this generous Jewish guy over Allah.
Who's actually made the promise.
Huh?
Who's actually made that promise.
Exactly,
you know?
Right. Now, sometimes it's an unbelievable criteria. I want a superwoman.
Besides the additional things that come into marriage, there's things that we have in our mind about the partner that we're going to marry. For example, I need a perfect man. You know, he's got the perfect akhlaq and he's got nothing negative in his traits.
Mm.
There's one thing that we need to understand is marriage isn't something, you know, you don't get everything ready in there. And you go on from there and just live your life perfectly as you dreamt of it. You have to compromise, or you have to be patient, you know. You have to learn to grow together as a partner. And it's even more beautiful, you know, because you go through those different phases of your personality through that with that person.
Yeah.
You know, which increases the beauty of that.
There's actually, off the back of that, there's actually a beautiful hadith that says that one who marries for beauty or for wealth will be deprived of both of them the moment they get married. And one who marries for iman, he is the one who will get both of those things.
That's mind-blowing.
You know? But this is what society has done through movies, through the media. It's created a kind of false expectation of what you would expect your life partner to be like. You know, we have all these standards of beauty now. We have all these glamorous icons, celebrities, and we all think that I want that.
Right. What about this? How many people are there that they really want to get to know their partner before they get married? What do you think about that? And they're like, oh, well, I don't. Well, the way it is in the West, people spend years and years together before they actually decide to get married, isn't it?
Engagement period?
No. I'm not talking about Muslims generally.
Right.
Yeah. And that has seeped into the Muslim youth mentality also. We're not in the Stone Age. We just decide to get married, and we don't even know the person we're getting into with marriage, right? What do you think about that?
I think it's very bad.
Yeah,
I
but
think
like
it's awful. that's one of the baggages of Western society, isn't it? It's one of those evil kind of outlooks which is seeped into our
thought. Me, as a critic, for example, say, fair enough, but I need to know the person I need to live with. You know, I might not like most of the things that person has after I get married. And is it not better to know the person and enter a lasting marriage than not knowing a person, getting into a marriage and, you know, ending up having an unsuccessful marriage?
Well, you need to know certain things, definitely. You need to know certain things, and Islam tells us to know about those things. But we're going to come back to this question. Very good question that Brother Mahdi Najafi has raised. Inshallah, before we come back to that, though, we're going to go for a short break.
We just have to open our eyes, our hearts and minds. If we just look right, we'll see the signs. We can't keep hiding from the truth and let it take us by surprise. Protect us in the best way. Guide us every single day. Keep us close to you until the end of time.
Before we went to the break, we were discussing about how certain people think that they need to spend time together before they get married. They need to know each other before they get married. My counter-argument, Brother Mahdi Najafi, would be, well, hold on a moment. You never know somebody. It takes a lifetime to even scratch the surface of what another person is. It
takes a lifetime to scratch the surface of one's own self.
This idea that, you know, you need to get to know somebody before you marry them is an illusion. It's not a reality.
But there has to be something that is standardized. And
So Islam does say certain things. So number one, check the person's iman. How? For example, you check their salah. Are they praying salah on time? Right? What is their connection to the Ahlul Bayt? Another thing is you check their family. got to check what kind of family they come from. Family has a huge impact on the person themselves, right?
And lastly, their friends.
Oh, yeah, and of course, their friends. Yeah. Now, these are all things that don't take, like, a significant amount of time to get to know.
If I'm a person that is deceptive, you know, I would easily form myself in a shape and manner that I could deceive another person. But the friends that I choose are the people closest to my personality that I'm going to hang around with, mm-hmm. and I'm going to choose.
Mm-hmm.
It's literally, it's next to impossible that I phase myself in a manner that my friends are different to the personality that I already have, you know.
Right.
So,
when it comes to friends, though, there's a beautiful hadith that says that if you want to know a person's deen, then you should look at their friends. Look at their circle of friends. That is their actual deen.
Yeah, that's actually interesting because nowadays, deen isn't even a priority now for us. Mm-hmm. You know? So that's where we get beat. Understand?
Yeah.
If we don't have that as a priority, later on in life, if your priority was, as you mentioned, the hadith, beauty or money, both of them are perishable and very vulnerable at any time, you know, right?
Mm-hmm.
But iman is something that is going to last, and that's something that might as well attract beauty and sustenance.
So, personal question for you. Did you have an arranged marriage? Did your parents choose your spouse? Or
It was both. It was both. You know.
Bit of both?
Bit of both, yeah.
Best of both worlds?
Yeah, you know. Yeah, I was one of the few lucky ones that had the option to have a bit of both. You know, I got to know my wife a bit, you know, as we mentioned, a bit before I got married. And the more you know about them after getting married, the more there is to marriage. Understand?
Yeah.
So if you think you've gotten to know the person, you've gotten to know the person before marriage, then there's not much left within the marriage for you anymore, you know. I don't want to say that, you know, marriage is just about knowing each other. There is much more to marriage, but a huge part of marriage is getting to know each other and changing and forming yourself in a manner to be compatible with the other person within the guidelines that Islam has provided us.
Which one do you think is better, actually, like arranged marriage or love marriage? They call it love marriage, but, you know, that's kind of deceptive because that means that arranged marriage doesn't have love in it.
Yeah, it is. It is, yeah.
Let's say, like, your choice. I mean, the person's choice or the parent's choice? Like, which one is better?
For me, I don't think I can say either one is better than the other. As we've mentioned, there are specific guidelines that Islam has provided us, right? As long as we're not... there's one thing that we might not be ordered to do in Islam. For example, we're ordered to respect our parents in Islam. That's fair enough. But we're not ordered to obey our parents blindly in Islam. Fair enough. But there's one thing that there's those orders in Islam, and there's certain laws within the creation of the human being, which includes not being successful when you disobey or rebel against your parents.
Yeah.
If they're Muslims. For example, Awais Qarani, he listened to his mother. He went to see the Prophet, peace be upon him, but he left because he promised his mom that he's going to return on a specific time. What I'm trying to say here is that if what you're doing, choosing a wife, may it not be arranged per se, and your parents are also okay with the person or the fact that you are looking at for a spouse by yourself, provided you're following the guidelines of Islam, then either one is, I think, suitable.
Well, the West has defined arranged marriage as a bad thing. You know, they've kind of synonymized it with forced marriage. They've kind of made it like that. I'm really happy, alhamdulillah, that my parents chose my spouse for me. I mean, I just pretty much went to their mum, dad, I want to get married, find somebody for me now. There's one thing that we need to give due attention to is that we're thick, aren't we? We're really, really stupid. Human beings are very, very... وَخُلِقَ الْإِنسَانُ ضَعِيفًا. You know, we have created human beings very weak. And so, naturally, when we look for a spouse, we look for those things which Shaitan wants us to look for. You know, looks or wealth or whatever it might be. We're not thinking outside of that. I remember when I got married, this random guy, I was walking in London, random guy, I don't know who he was, he just comes up to me and he goes, did you get married? And I go, yeah, we just got married. And then he goes, parents' choice? I go, yes. He goes, parents' choice? Choice of God. And then he leaves. And I was like, whoa.
No.
Okay. And in London, that's strange. You don't get that many religious people in London, right? Strike that. You do, but not quite like that.
Yeah,
so
no.
It got me thinking, like, how can you make your choices as per what Allah wants? And I feel like this is a really good way to get your parents involved. No?
Yeah, it is. Because, for example, your mum, she might know you much better than you do know yourself, isn't it? So,
yeah, as much as you might not like to admit it.
I'm going to second you on whatever you said, that they know much better than we do ourselves. And even if you are out looking for a spouse by yourself, and I'd just advise that it's not against the will of your parents.
Ahsant, right. There is this rebellious streak that I feel like people do fall into the trap of, that mainstream media, if you look at any movies, I mean, if you take, like, I don't know, Disney movies, for example, they kind of subconsciously train you that your best possible spouse is the one that your parents don't approve of. Have you seen this theme? It's a recurring theme in romantic movies, wherever you see. It's always this idea that it's not the parents' choice.
Even if they cut out the parents' part, everyone is against what you want. That's something that's there. That everyone is against, even if the character in the movie or whatever it is doesn't have parents. Their best friend, for example, is going to oppose their choice, or the society, whoever is around him opposes that choice. But it turns out that, that is the best thing for them.
That's all right, because we're out of time now. We hope that you enjoyed and benefited from the show, dear listeners. Inshallah, we'll see you next time. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
A report released recently by the United Nations Refugee Agency finds that more than 82 million people across the globe were forcibly displaced by war, persecution, the climate crisis, and other factors by the end of 2020, a record high that one international aid group called an epic failure of humanity. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Epic Failure of Humanity. Global displaced population hits all-time high. Stay tuned for more. Released recently by the United Nations Refugee Agency finds that more than 82 million people across the globe were forcibly displaced by war, persecution, the climate crisis, and other factors by the end of 2020, a record high that one international aid group called an epic failure of humanity. The UN's annual Global Trends in Forced Displacement Assessment estimates that girls and boys under the age of 18 account for 42% of the 82.4 million people who have fled their homes in search of safety and basic human dignity. Nearly a million children were born as refugees between 2018 and 2020, the report shows. Behind each number is a person forced from their home and a story of displacement, dispossession, and suffering. They merit attention and support, not just with humanitarian aid, but in finding solutions to their plight, said Filippo Grandi, the High Commissioner of the United Nations for Refugees, UNHCR, adding, "The tragedy of so many children being born into exile should be reason enough to make far greater efforts to prevent and end conflict and violence. Though the deadly coronavirus pandemic led countries around the world to close off their borders to refugees and asylum seekers, many people still fled across national lines in 2020, the ninth consecutive year in which the number of forcibly displaced people has reached a record high. According to the new UN report, 26.4 million people were living as refugees in 2020, and more than two-thirds of those who fled abroad came from just five countries, including Syria, 6.7 million, Afghanistan, 2.6 million, South Sudan, 2.2 million, and Myanmar, 1.1 million. The UN figures show that in addition to those who were forced by circumstance to leave their home countries, 48 million people were internally displaced by the end of last year, up from 45.7 million in 2019. Climate change is driving displacement and increasing the vulnerability of those already forced to flee, the report states. Forcibly displaced and stateless people are on the front lines of the climate emergency. Many are living in climate hotspots where they typically lack the resources to adapt to an increasingly inhospitable environment. The dynamics of poverty, food insecurity, climate change, conflict, and displacement are increasingly interconnected and mutually reinforcing, driving more and more people to search for safety and security. Jan Egeland, Secretary General for the Norwegian Refugee Council, said in a statement recently that despite the staggering statistics, world leaders have been inept to resolve the greatest emergency of our generation. Far more people are on the move today than anything and any time during the Second World War. Yet we say we live in an unprecedented era of global peacetime, he added. We need to rewrite tomorrow's history books to reflect today's reality that we live in an unprecedented era of persecution and suffering. Absent dramatic action from the international community to end conflicts, combat the climate crisis, and mitigate other major factors driving forced displacement, the UN report warns that forecasts for 2021 are equally worrying, with some of the world's worst food crises, including in displacement-affected countries such as South Sudan, Syria, and the Central African Republic, at risk of turning into famine. The question is no longer if forced displacement will exceed 100 million people, but rather when, the report states. Clearly, the need for preventing conflicts and ensuring that displaced people have access to solutions has never been more pressing than now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions.
culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Leader's speech in meeting with members of Assembly of Experts. This is part of a speech delivered on August 31st, 2006 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with members of the Assembly of Experts.
Another important goal is attending to underprivileged and remote areas. These are among our dreams. Besides, one can see that there are open and active minds with scholarly outlooks among the people who work today in the administration and the executive branch. Apart from their work ethics, we can see in official reports and during the meetings that we have with a number of honorable ministers that the behavior is based on reason and scholarly outlooks, and that they do not show negligence in making calculations. In the present time, programs are like this. They are thinking, working, and evaluating different issues. They take action and move forward in a constant and incessant way. This is very valuable. A young, enthusiastic, and fresh group of people have entered the arena and are working very well. I have heard and seen the propaganda that exists against the current positions and orientations. These propaganda efforts are mostly made by our opponents outside the country and those who are opposed to the essence of the Islamic Republic. These things are in front of our eyes. We watch and listen to all the news in this regard, and we know whom the target of this propaganda is and whose minds they want to deceive. Truth is what I said. Good tasks, in the real sense of the word, are being carried out in every area. Well, the result is that a kind of enthusiasm has been generated in the people, particularly youth. The people have the enthusiasm to work and to be hopeful and optimistic about the future. We can understand and feel this from the meetings that we have with the people and from other sources. The same condition exists in the arena of foreign policy. Today, our dynamism and enthusiasm in the area of foreign policy are good. We can see this great dynamism and enthusiasm and these vast activities. On many global issues, particularly on regional issues, the initiative is in the hands of the Islamic Republic. The fact that the initiative is in the hands of the Islamic Republic is an unprecedented and unique phenomenon.
To Allah. supporters.
Yemen's Ansarullah movement blamed the United Nations for the Saudi atrocities committed against Yemeni children. The movement said the UN has always been providing the political cover-up for the Saudi war crimes. This came after the United Nations added the Ansarullah movement to its blacklist for groups for violating children's rights.
We were not surprised by this decision because the UN had removed the name of Saudi Arabia from its blacklist of the groups violating children's rights. The United Nations have not taken any real steps to protect the rights of Yemeni children who die every day due to continued blockade on food, medicine, and fuel. I believe that this is a resounding scandal for the Secretary General of the UN, who began his second term with this decision.
The member of the Supreme Political Council, Mohammed Al-Houthi, dismissed as baseless the UN accusation, saying it did not refer to an investigation on the ground as the movement has demanded. Meanwhile, the Minister of Information said the UN has turned a blind eye to the ongoing Saudi blockade on Yemenis, which causes the death of tens of Yemeni children on a daily basis. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war against Yemen in March 2015. The war has killed thousands of civilians, including women and children, and turned the war-torn country into the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations.
Observers say the United Nations' blacklisting of Ansarullah is politically motivated and has no relation to the humanitarian situation in Yemen. They believe that the UN must take real actions against the Saudi blockade if it has real intentions to end the suffering of millions of Yemenis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Supporters of Palestinians' struggle for their rights and justice gathered in front of the headquarters and branches of RAI, the Italian national broadcaster, to protest against what they call biased coverage of the ongoing conflict between Israel and Palestine. The demonstration took place in several cities, including Rome, Milan, and Naples. Protesters shouting "Shame" and "Israel, go away" accused the national broadcaster of misrepresenting the complexity of the latest Israeli war on the Gaza Strip, as well as ridiculing the truth.
The reports on the Israeli-Palestine conflict that RAI TV has been airing were not up to the standards one would expect from a public broadcaster. Italian people have been clever enough to understand the truth. It's no coincidence that pro-Palestine demonstrations were held in 25 cities across the country. The reports never mentioned the Israeli occupation, never once.
People attending Rome's demonstration said the Italian media outlets faced no ethical dilemmas when it came to not reporting on the Israelis who were trying to steal Palestinians' houses in Sheikh Jarrah in Jerusalem or Quds.
Italian mainstream media generally covers Palestinians when they are either protesting or physically confronting Israeli aggression, with the outcry broadly described as escalation of violence. Quite the contrary when it comes to describing Israel's increasing night raids on Palestinian homes and attacks by Israeli settlers on Palestinian farmers, Italian media hardly refers to an escalation of violence.
Last Saturday, thousands of people flooded the central square in the Italian capital to show their support to the Palestinians, but no mainstream media outlets bothered to cover the demonstration.
The media didn't elaborate on what was happening in Italy. They showed, you know, London, New York, other places in the world, and they didn't really focus on all of Italy was protesting against this occupation.
Unfortunately, nothing will change if the UN and all major countries continue not to take a firm stance on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
A national demonstration dubbed Stop the Israeli Occupation will be held in Rome on Saturday, May 29. Thousands of Italians are expected to join the rally from all over the country. Max Civili, Rome.
This
a quick one. When are you going to...
He might have emerged the loser in a bitter internal power struggle inside Downing Street. But Dominic Cummings is reminding his former allies inside the Conservative Party that a wounded animal is at its most dangerous. Prime Minister Johnson is standing by his health secretary, even after Cummings' leaked messages where Johnson branded the man in charge of handling Britain's COVID crisis as expletive hopeless and suggested handing over some of his responsibilities.
Dominic Cummings is doing this because he's his own axe to grind following his sacking as Johnson's political aide. It's clear I don't think we could trust him as far as you could throw him, but at the same time he's shedding light on what seems to be a chaotic and inefficient government whose handling of the beginnings of this pandemic was truly disastrous in terms of the number of people dying, the highest in Europe.
In an escalation of tensions between Cummings and Hancock, MPs were told back in May that the health secretary had lied to the prime minister about testing hospital patients before they were released into care homes at the start of the pandemic. In a 7,000-word blog, Cummings described Johnson and co. of rewriting history and said if number 10 is prepared to lie so deeply and widely about such vital issues of life and death last year, it cannot now be trusted either on COVID or any other crucial issue of war and peace.
Hell hath no fury like a special advisor scorned, and Dominic Cummings is making life inside the Conservative Party for his former colleagues an absolute nightmare. After all, he's the man with an agenda and the inside information to follow through.
Cummings's refusal to slink off into the political wilderness must be a source of great concern for the government, who must be dreading what he will reveal next.
I don't think he's particularly bothered about the damage he might inflict on the Conservative Party, or indeed his former boss Boris Johnson. Clearly his anger over his sacking has overcome any reservations he's got.
This might be unfolding like a poorly written telenovela, but the public will do well to be reminded that these individuals at the center of this political drama, they were the ones in charge, making decisions that may well have cost thousands of people their lives. Amina Taylor, London.
For ages, joining the North Atlantic Treaty Organization has been a long-sought dream for Ukraine. NATO countries have a mutual defense pact, meaning if one nation is attacked, the others will join in their response. By this, Kiev, which has been engaged in a domestic conflict with pro-Russian forces, is seeking to get NATO's help to get rid of the militias. On Monday, the alliance's annual summit in Brussels wrapped up with the release of a joint communique that reaffirmed NATO's 2008 decision for Ukraine to become a member through a Membership Action Plan, or MAP, without setting a timetable. Shortly afterward, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky appeared to announce a change on Twitter shortly before U.S. President Joe Biden began a news conference in Brussels where he was attending a NATO summit. He tweeted that NATO leaders confirmed that Ukraine will become a member of the alliance. But NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg made it clear that no such action was imminent. Stoltenberg said, "To agree on the membership action plan, you need a consensus among 30 allies. This was the focus of the summit." Biden stressed that Kiev does not have the go-ahead to join NATO. The U.S. president said Ukraine needs to clean up corruption and to meet other criteria before it gets into the action plan. However, he affirmed Washington's support for Ukraine's territorial integrity. Biden also met with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin for the first time in Geneva, Switzerland on Wednesday. The two discussed a number of issues, including resumption of diplomatic ties and the return of expelled envoys, but apparently made no mention of Ukraine's membership in NATO. On Thursday, the Kremlin expressed concern over talks for Ukraine to join the alliance. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Ukraine's